You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be one, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Ready? Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig, PA, and Boilermakers, Local 83. Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. And this show is sponsored by the proud union, Boilermakers, Local 83, from the Kansas City, Missouri office and Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we'll explore the secret history and moral cost of the iPhone, its global supply chain, and why it's called the one device. Then, after too many instances of sexual harassment and attack, Chicago hotel workers, members of Unite Here Local 1, got the city council to pass the hands-off, pants-on ordinance to protect them. Find out about how they did it on tonight's show. In the news, first Dollar General store to unionize in U.S. is right here in Missouri. And rail workers demonstrate against blaming workers for rail disasters caused by bad policies. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. Her stories include grain bin deaths start off 2018 and the most important safety news story of 2017. And finally, Trump administration undoing safety rules written to prevent another Deepwater Horizon disaster. Now for the news. This is the news from our side, January 4th, 2018. The Jefferson City, Missouri News Tribune reports employees at the OVAS, I think that's how you pronounce it, Dollar General Store have agreed to unionize. Last month, a majority of the OVAS store workers voted in favor of letting United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 655, represent them in bargaining with the corporation. According to union spokesperson Colin Reichman, based at the Local 655's St. Louis office, they're the first Dollar General workers in the nation to vote for union representation. As of November 3rd, Dollar General operated 14,321 stores in 44 states, according to the corporate website. Reichman said, while he didn't have an exact number of employees, they voted at a 2-to-1 margin in favor of the union. Dollar General did not confirm or deny that figure. The process got started 1 or 2 months ago when Dollar General employees reached out to the union, he said. Dollar General Corporation responded to the News Tribune questions with a written statement which said, quote, "We are very disappointed in the vote and continue to believe that a union is not in our employees' best interests. In the coming days, we will evaluate next steps," unquote. Since the vote, Reichman said, the union has seen an uptick in interest from other prospective members, although he declined to name specific companies. Here at this union, he said, and a lot of other locals at this state, we're growing.
The Austin, Texas American Statesman reports the Communication Workers Union is suing AT&T on behalf of 50 employees in Austin and Bastrop, Texas, who were laid off as AT&T announced firings across the United States. News of the firings spread rapidly, fueled by national outrage, following AT&T's earlier announcement that that the company was doling out $1,000 bonuses to 200,000 of its employees in celebration of the Republican Party's tax overhaul. CWA filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday in the Austin Division of the U.S. District Court. In the suit, the organization characterizes the layoffs as, quote, unprecedented, unquote. The union found out about the layoffs on December 12th, and employees were notified on December 14th, quote, less than 2 weeks before the employees' Christmas holiday, unquote, the suit says. It alleges that AT&T's selection of the timing and schedule for this massive deprivation of employment was an extraordinary act of corporate cruelty. The suit demands that a judge require AT&T to reinstate all these laid-off employees. The layoffs included 40 premises technicians in Kansas City, Missouri. Austin, Bastrop, Texas had the single largest group with 50. The lawsuit argues that AT&T primarily laid these people off to diminish the union's collective bargaining power in its district. AT&T responded saying, quote, the fact is the allegations in the lawsuit are baseless. We comply with the terms of our collective bargaining agreements and did so in this case. The lawsuit says that AT&T is subcontracting out work that laid-off employees are qualified to perform. The suit adds that an additional 561 AT&T employees from Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas will also be cut on February 17th, but does not specify what jobs will be affected. AT&T blames the layoffs on technology and declining demand for legacy services.
The trial of three railway employees involved in the 2013 runaway train disaster in Lac Mégantic, Quebec. A train carrying crude oil was stopped for the night on a hill leading into town. The brakes slipped and the train careened down on the town, derailed and exploded, killing 47 people and destroying part of the downtown core. Three now ex-railway employees were accused each of one count of criminal negligence. The driver, the director of train operations, and the traffic controller. Today in a Canadian court, the train manager's lawyer said his client had no say in safety-related decisions made in the United States by the parent company of Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic Railway. Railroad Workers United, a rank-and-file organization of rail workers in North America, agrees and has been holding demonstrations all week in support of the Quebec rail workers. They are calling for authorities to drop the charges. They say they want real rail safety and accountability regarding rail disasters rather than diversionary prosecution of rail workers who have no control over the majority of the causes identified by government reports and independent investigations. Disasters like the one in Quebec are the result, they say, of risky decisions and policies by railroad managers and their government regulatory enablers. Meanwhile, Railroad Workers United issued a statement about the Amtrak Train 501 derailment in DuPont, Washington, on December 18, 2017, on a 30-mile-per-hour curve, which killed three and injured scores of others. Soon after, it came to light that the train was traveling at 78 miles per hour, well above the prescribed speed. Coming on the heels of at least five major passenger train wrecks in the U.S. over the course of the last decade, they question, why do these tragedies continue to occur? They say train wrecks are the result of a constellation of factors, many hidden from view and potentially years in the making. Blaming the worker who screwed up misses the point. Factors causing accidents have to do with corporate and government policy and include, but are not limited to, poor work schedules, chronic crew fatigue, limited time off work, inadequate staffing, lack of training, improper qualifying, task overload, deferred maintenance, antiquated infrastructure, and failures to implement available safety technology. It is almost never just one of these factors, but a very complex web that, when taken together, can result in disaster.
The next time residents of Durham County, North Carolina, feel the itch to spontaneously express political feelings on public grounds, they'd better hope someone had the foresight to ask permission 2 days earlier. Think Progress reports the Durham County Commission opened the new year with a proposal to require 48 hours notice before any demonstration on county-owned land. In order to ensure the safety of all involved in and near demonstrations on county grounds prior to notification, is required if the group will be 50 or more individuals or has the potential of 50 or more individuals, the rules before the commission on Tuesday state. if notification is not given within the stated requirements or if a spontaneous group exceeds 50 individuals, the county manager or his or her designee may determine that those participating in the demonstration on county grounds are trespassing and may request that participants be removed by law enforcement. The news this evening was read by Judy Ansel, Jake White, Jen Zaman, and I'm Greg Swartz.
Like gold, can you hear me calling at you? Ooh. Tell me, baby, where'd you stay last night? Yes, your hair's all tangled, dress don't fit you right. Can you hear me crying? Oh, oh, oh.
Good evening, everyone. This is Jacob White. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the iPhone, the one device. If you ask your Amazon or your Amazon Alexa or your Google what the most important invention of the 21st century is, they might tell you that it's the iPhone. And we all know the iPhone is made by the most valuable company in the world, Apple, which, strangely enough, owns virtually no physical assets. The iPhone sort of looks like it could have crash-landed from outer space. Tim Cook, Apple's current CEO, once called it Jetson stuff. I was hoping tonight to interview Brian Merchant, but he wound up not being available. And I want to talk about his book anyways, because what this book manages to do is to demystify the iPhone in a way that lets us see the labor and the material and the supply lines that actually go into making the iPhone. Tonight's music was Smokestack Lightning by Watermelon Slim, and I'm here with Judy Ansel. She's going to help me as I sort of give this book report about The One Device by Brian Merchant.
Well, gosh, Jake, this sounds like a book that anybody who owns an iPhone ought to read in order to understand where it comes from. So I guess I'm going to have to get a copy because I have an iPhone, and I'm a pretty loyal iPhone user. I even forget with my Google Mini Home device, I say, "Hey Siri," and it doesn't wake up. Oops,
my phone just woke up.
Yeah, aren't they amazing?
So ubiquitous, a very ubiquitous technology, and we're now.
Yeah. Anyway. I turned off my phone, but Siri just came through. Okay, so we're going to talk about the supply chain. So we're going to start in the United States. How are the conditions for the people who work in the Apple stores? I've been to the Apple store on the plaza, and I know they're always busy.
So Apple stores are always really busy, especially around times that there's new releases. One of the things that Apple does is it has these new releases and everyone gets super excited about it. They have a cult following and the line goes around the corner. But one thing we don't really think about is, what does that mean for the retail workers at the Apple store? Well, for one thing, a lot of them are really, really enthusiastic about Apple products.
Yeah, so I've noticed that.
They call themselves geeks or geniuses, and they're really enthusiastic about it. At the end of the day, though, it's a retail job, and a lot of people who work at Apple stores will work close to full-time, except Apple considers them part-time so that they don't have to pay them benefits, especially around the holiday season or around new releases. There's always longer hours, and like you said, just constant. There's not really any slowdown time. So not long ago, some Apple workers made a website, actually just called AppleRetailUnion.com. And this story is sort of instructive about the way that Apple handles its labor, because immediately they threw a ton of resources into, you know, what they call union training materials for management.
Apple did this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To make sure that they, you know, the workers didn't get too far ahead of themselves in the retail stores.
Yeah, right.
You know, with this whole crazy idea. On the other hand, though, they did see some results from their efforts to unionize, even though it didn't wind up happening. Some workers saw as much as $3 to $4 an hour in increased wages.
Mm.
So, as we'll see as we go further into this book, when it comes to the Apple supply chain, the workers at the Apple store, you know, are pretty happy. They're in air-conditioned places, or, you know, with this weather, they're heated, but it's still not great.
Let me ask you a question. Is part of Apple's business model to have too few stores and keep them understaffed so that people somehow think that Apple's more special than maybe it is? You know, because, I mean, there aren't many Apple stores for the number of people who have the product, and you have to wait, you have to get an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just, if you walk in, you end up waiting a long time.
That's a really interesting question. The book didn't necessarily address that head on, but I think that it might have something to do with the way that Apple sort of makes it exclusive to work there. Like, you're really enthusiastic about the products, maybe you get a little bit of a discount, and then, yeah, it does sort of seem like it's an exclusive thing. At the end of the day, you're a retail worker, you need dental work, you need to go see a doctor,
and you don't have
benefits. Full-time salary, and Apple's not always too happy to meet you at, you know, those things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now moving out from the U.S., I know you're skipping Silicon Valley, but does the book go into that at all?
Oh, yeah, it definitely does.
Okay, but we're not going to talk about
maybe
that.
If we have a little time at the
end. Okay, so going out from the U.S., there's this place called Cerro Rico. Why should people know about it?
Well, Cerro Rico is very interesting because, first of all, it's a 500-year-old city. So when the Spanish conquistadors came to the New World, they found this mountain, and they realized that it was an extremely rich mountain.
That's what it means.
Yes. And, Jack Weatherford, he's a famous anthropologist, and he called it the first and probably most important monument to capitalism, because what they pulled out of Cerro Rico was money, right? They would take the ore, and then they would mine it and turn it into coins and send it to China or send it to Spain.
What was the ore, silver?
Yeah, silver and some gold also.
Oh, I remember reading about those places were just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thousands of people died.
Yes.
Mining under
millions
the Spanish.
Might not be.
Yeah, if you want to read about that, read Galeano's book, The Open Veins of Latin America. He talks all about that.
Yeah, so teeming, huge city, even in the 1600s, bigger than London, full of African slaves, full of indigenous people, full of Spanish people. Today, 15,000 miners a day still go to work in Cerro Rico.
What are they mining?
All sorts of stuff, copper and tin, a lot of the materials that go into your iPhone. And some of these workers are as young as age 6. So one of the reasons I wanted to have Brian on was because he actually went to Cerro Rico, and he actually went down into the mines. And what he took away from it really was the people who are extracting the materials that make our phones, like, we wouldn't stand their conditions for even 15 minutes going down there into the mine. And the mountain itself is really structurally unstable because for 500 years it's been getting picked out of.
And where is this?
It's in Bolivia,
uh-huh.
In South America. And every day 15,000 miners go to work there. And it's a part of the supply chain for almost any technology that you get, a lot of key material comes from that mountain.
Okay, and then moving out of this continent or this hemisphere, well, of course, we have to talk about Asia and I suppose China. So what did the book have to say about Apple's famous model of designed in California and made in China approach?
So, like I said at the beginning, Apple is somehow the world's most valuable company, even though it doesn't own any physical assets. So when Ford was the most valuable company in the world, it owned factories, it owned plants.
Dealers.
All sorts of physical assets. Apple outsources all of that stuff. And 82% of the suppliers are contracted from Asia. So there's 748 different suppliers that provide materials and provide components for Apple products. And 4 out of every 5 of those are based in Asia. So when we think of Apple, the iPhone, you know, it's sort of like designed almost to look like no one built it, like it came from outer space. But the reality is it's an enormously complex combination. And it's pretty famous at this point. But Brian was able to go to a Foxconn facility in China. And I say facility because it's not really a factory. It's like a mega factory, I guess you could say. And it's almost like an old company town because you have all these smokestacks, all these factories, a lot of things that OSHA might not be approving of, you know, unsafe conditions
like,
for construction
workers.
Like the nets
to catch the workers that jump out of the window?
Right, yeah. Or, you know, pools of chemicals that might just be, you know, lying around without anyone really looking after them. But, yeah, what he saw there was basically a lot of people have free time when they're not working in the factory, but there's nothing to do except for go to the company store, pretty much. So there's bars and restaurants and stuff within the Foxconn facility.
And they live there, too.
And they live there. There's dorms within the Foxconn facility.
Dorms?
He did see the dorms.
How many people live in a room?
You know, it's really crowded in there. And he was actually able to shake off his handlers when he was there. And very few people from the West are able to actually go to a Foxconn mega factory and to look around and to see what the, you know, beyond what your handlers want you to see. And, you know, he never saw anyone smiling, which is pretty sad. There were no, like, libraries or parks or anywhere where people could just sit around. Like, if you wanted to go out and do some leisure outside of, you know, working in the factory, you had to go to somewhere where you were going to a company-owned store, basically giving your money
back
to the
company. So how well are those people paid?
You know, comparatively for China, it's not great. But if you look, I mean, comparatively for China, it's not bad. There's students that want to work there. There's people mm-hmm. who come from the countryside that want to work there and sort of see it as like a
way
to get to
a aren't most of the workers
life.
Migrants from the
yeah.
from other places, mostly rural?
Yeah, China. attracted for the jobs.
Well, it's also because the Chinese have had systematic disinvestment in the countryside.
Yeah.
And it's the real poverty in China is in the countryside, and so they're forced to leave, mm-hmm. which has created this army of workers that have made China this colossus of manufacturing.
And the outsourcing has really, you could sort of look at Apple as like an iceberg. What we normally think about is the top part, the uh-huh. visible part. But the underneath is this enormous invisible amount of, you know, workers and materials and things that get gathered from poor countries like China and Bolivia, you know, countries that have been
Where else are they producing? Are they producing in Vietnam, too?
A little bit, I think.
But it's mostly China?
Yeah, 82% in Asia. So there's Vietnam and Thailand, and with 748 suppliers, you have to figure
right.
that there's a lot of different places. And but the depressed labor costs – oh, were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say, but Foxconn is not Chinese. It's Taiwanese.
Ah, yes.
As a corporation, which is sort of – like, it operates as a foreign corporation in China, but obviously gets a lot of perks for being there.
So if these economists, researchers at Kramer, Linden, and Diedrich did a study, and they found out that if Apple assembled their products in the United States, instead of costing $45 for each iPhone to be assembled, it would cost $442, right? And the retail cost is $500. Mm-hmm. So there goes Apple's crazy profit margin, right? And then if you add to that not just the people who do the assembly, but also miners, extractors, mm-hmm. further down the supply chain, the cost for paying them American wages would be $210 instead of $35, which is what they pay now.
So I assume the takeaway of this is that Apple's business model is not based on its great technology. It's based on its horrific exploitation of labor. Is that it?
I wouldn't disagree with you, Judy. I think a lot of people like Apple products and are kind of willing to overlook that. But I think that a lot of the emphasis now is on this idea of intangibles, research and development, education, innovation, things like that. Uh-huh. But when we get down to the meat and potatoes of it.
It wouldn't be possible without the cheap labor.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Right.
So finally, I know we're just about out of time. Okay. Who is Wayne Westerman?
Okay. So this is the last part, and this is sort of a local thing that I didn't know about. And thank you, Brian, for bringing this to my attention. But Wayne Westerman graduated from Belton High School. Uh-huh. He was the valedictorian, just down 71 from here. And he had sort of like carpal tunnel. He had repetitive muscle problems in his hands. And so he realized that touchpads are less repetitive and require fewer keystrokes than keyboards. So the touchpad originally was designed in order to help people that have carpal tunnel and other hand disabilities use an interface with technology. And Apple came across this and was like, this is a great idea. We'll buy it from you. And they did. And now the average American touches their phone 2,617 times a day. That adds up for all Americans to 8 billion times a year.
My gosh.
And I think that if we're ever going to replace the J.C. Nichols fountain, Wayne Westerman is the guy.
So is Wayne Westerman the richest guy in Belton?
I don't think he lives in Belton anymore.
Oh, shucks.
He lives in Silicon Valley. But the book we've been talking about today is The One Device by Brian Merchant. And Judy, thank you very much for helping me out with my book report. And this has been Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum. Have a great day.
And stay tuned. We're going to be talking about hotel workers and sexual harassment in the second part of the show.
KKFI is sustained by generous listener support. Thank you for 30 years of belief in Kansas City Community Radio.
In 1968, a radical wave crashed across the globe, changing the world and its people politically, socially, and culturally. War, marches, assassinations, students took to the streets to speak out against war and injustice. Music reflected a newfound voice, and Pacifica Radio was there to record it all.
What we're going to do in the year 1968 is going to determine the future of this country for decades and decades ahead.
Please tune in to the Pacifica Radio Archives special documentary, Revolution Rewind 1968, covering one of the most explosive years in recent history.
Thursday night at 7, right after Heartland Labor Forum.
Hey there, boys. We know the last couple months have been frickin' insane.
All these big, cool, powerful guys are turning out to be, what's the word? Habitual predators?
Cat's out of the bag. Women get harassed all the time.
And it's like, dang, is this the world now?
But here's a little secret that every girl knows.
Oh, this been the damn world.
It's freaky, it's nasty, it's button under the desk bag. But this is our hometown, we'll show you around. Welcome to hell. Now we're look around, isn't it nice? It's a full nightmare. Ain't it so cool playing this guess who?
a girl group. We just travel in a pack for safety.
This is how I walk home at night.
My dad gave me a pink gun, so there's a lot there.
My little trick? If someone's following me, I put my arm up like this, and I go, ah! Because then he'll be like, she's not worth the trouble.
Welcome to hell. Now you're in our boat. Look at that guy, what is he up to in that trench coat? It's like a maze here, all full of boners. Hey, what was that?
Phew, just a cat. Wait, who owns the cat?
Could be a trap. Welcome to hell.
I guess it begs the question, whoa, why didn't you say something, baby girl?
Well, dang, Double Daddy. We definitely did. For hundreds of years.
Aw, oh, man.
But I guess no one, like, cared.
Because it kept happening again.
What?
And again.
Really?
And again.
Oh, come on!
Hey, just wanted to say, I think what you guys are doing is really cool. I get it. But you do know that it's like a million times worse for a woman of color, right?
Oh, my God. Yes.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Well, let's get back into this.
Now, House of Cards is ruined, and that really sucks. Well, here's a list of stuff that's ruined for us.
Parking and walking and Uber and ponytails, bathrobes and nighttime and drinking and hotels and beds.
Nothing good happens in a bed.
Welcome to hell.
Welcome to hell.
This isn't news.
No, 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 not news.
Our situation's been...
Okay, and if you didn't recognize that, that was last week's Saturday Night Live, and it's just perfect for what's coming up. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. In November, author Barbara Ehrenreich tweeted, "Our current sex harassment discussion is woefully class skewed. Too much about actresses and not enough about hotel housekeepers." Well, hotel housekeepers have actually been very busy fighting to protect themselves from prominent and not so prominent hotel guests like Harvey Weinstein. And on October 11th, 2017, the Chicago City Council passed the Hands Off Pants On ordinance to provide hospitality workers greater protections against sexual harassment and assault. The ordinance requires all hotels in the city to adopt a panic button system and an anti-sexual harassment policy. The ordinance was passed after months of lobbying efforts by local hospitality workers who are members of Unite Here Local 1, the union that represents hotel workers. The passage of this ordinance put Chicago in the forefront of recent efforts to stomp out sexual harassment. With us to talk about how they achieved this victory are Sarah Lyons and Casey Knowles, both members of Unite Here Local 1, who were very active in the campaign. Welcome to both of you, Sarah and Casey.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So first, let's start out by going through what the three parts of the ordinance are. Do you want to take that, Sarah?
Sure. I think as you stated, the hands-off, pants-on ordinance requires hotels to provide all hotel workers who work alone in guest rooms or restrooms with panic buttons by July 1st, 2018. And so folks who may not know what a panic button is a portable device that you can quickly use to alert hotel security if you feel unsafe, and the hotel is required to immediately send someone to your aid. The other part of the ordinance requires hotels to draft, maintain, and comply with an anti-sexual harassment policy that specifically addresses sexual harassment by guests. And that under that policy gives workers different protections, but including the ability to stop work and leave the immediate area if a guest is a sexual harasser, to have a temporary work reassignment to work on a different floor away from the guest, and be given paid time to file a police report or testify in legal proceedings about the incident. And then I think thirdly, really importantly, is that it specifically prohibits any retaliation. It would be against the law for the hotel to retaliate against a hotel worker for using panic button, reporting sexual harassment by a guest, or exercising any of the rights or protections under the ordinance.
Okay, so I imagine this was a long time in coming. Hotel workers have been harassed for years, And I remember the famous case of, who was it, the head of the World Bank in New York?
Right, IMF.
IMF, that's right. Who was accused of raping or attempting to rape a hospitality worker. And that got a lot of national attention, but then it seemed to die down. So tell us, what were some of the experiences that your members had that led you to decide to take up the campaign for this ordinance? You want to talk about that, Casey?
Yeah. So basically we started last April. It was about five of us. We did a survey in Chicago amongst the Union Hotel, and we had our survey. We asked, we actually went on, you know, into the hotels and we talked to the housekeepers. We know our members, right? So we interviewed them, right, and asked them different questions. And the first question you always ask is, have you ever been sexually harassed? Oh, I'm sorry. Have you ever been sexually harassed? And the first answer is always no. And so then you start to ask other questions, and then, you know, they like, you get an aha moment, right? So a lot of them, they don't know that they've been sexually harassed, or they put it back. They choose not to think about it. We've had women that has been attacked, literally jumped over beds to get away, fondled, approached with sexual favors, touched, you know, and other verbal gestures, you know, that's very degrading. As a cocktail server myself, I'm not in the housekeeping thing, you know, I'm not a housekeeper or room attendant, I should say, but I do come from the hospitality industry. And so that's what made me get involved in it as well, because I am also a victim of this type of behavior, in which you do get those rude comments. When you're part of a large company, you have people that come in and they actually feel like you're part of the amenities. So, and that's a nice way to say it. Yeah, you know, you get a lot of gestures, you know, sexual favors. They want sexual favors or touching you. And I've just my own personal observation, I've seen that it was more against those that don't really speak that much English.
You have a lot of members who are immigrants, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we represent over 15,000 hospitality workers in the Chicago area, and many of whom are immigrants and women of color. So we're majority women. Frankly, and many of whom, you know, English is not their first language. But I think what Casey was saying in terms of the harassment that our members started to share about their experiences when we were doing the survey, you know, it becomes really clear that there's just a stark power imbalance between, you know, the women who are cleaning the rooms and the man who can afford to pay hundreds of dollars a night. And that power imbalance, you know, I think amplifies the risk that these women face every day when they're at work.
Mm-hmm. Instead of fixing the problem, the company's way of fixing the problem is to remove you from the problem. Mm-hmm. So, as far as you being a worker there, you feel expendable. Because you can't compare to the money that's being brought in. You can't measure up to that. So that's the case in point.
So typically, if a worker had made a complaint before this ordinance, what would the hotel would have, like, just moved them or fired them or something like that and let the perpetrator off the hook?
I think what we saw, yeah, there's lots of different responses, ways that women themselves were figuring out how to deal with this. That I think the first thing to say is that this was happening. When we found out that 49% of the hotel housekeepers had a guest expose themselves, flash them, or answer the door naked, that was kind of a moment where we all had to say, "Oh my gosh, this is." Mm-hmm. This is not just one bad apple. This is not just a one-off incident. This is happening. This is widespread, and frankly, it's rampant. So we had to sort of take a moment, you know, to absorb that, and then we had to look and see, how do people feel like they can even talk about it? And I think that
That was really a moment where we realized that only one in three of the women we spoke to who had had the experience of being harassed at work chose to report it or to a manager or supervisor. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, a variety of obstacles or reasons that people feel like they can't even talk about it. And I think what our what Casey and the survey team did back in April 2016 really helped start to break open the silence that was surrounding this issue of harassment by guests in particular.
And I imagine, you know, most unions pay attention to the bread and butter issues, and they don't have a tradition of fighting over these kinds of issues. Isn't that true?
Look, you know, I think as a labor movement, this is, you know, harassment is a safety issue. And I think what we've, you know, I were really proud to see that the Chicago Federation of Labor actually took on this issue and spearheaded the legislative initiative, you know, taking it up as a workers' rights issue, as a safety issue. You know, I think we're, you know, hopeful that we're going to see more and more of that. But, you know, from the beginning, this campaign was launched, with the voices of housekeepers, but also with the leadership of our president, Jorge Ramirez, of the Chicago Fed, and actually many male labor union leaders in Chicago who were featured in a video to sort of that helped springboard this campaign into public attention. So I think, you know, that's an important piece of how this campaign came to be, too.
Well, that's really interesting, and it's really encouraging, too, that you got such wide support. So how did you get the city council's attention? Were there individual members of the council who really, you know, like, identified with this, or was it a really hard push?
Well, I think it started with the launch itself. You know, when we released the report, which is all the survey statistics, it was accompanied by this video with Chicago union leaders speaking out on this issue. And that, I think, really helped change the conversation and the tone where, you know, together the labor movement of Chicago said, we're going to back up these workers and we're going to push for a policy to protect these folks at work because everyone deserves to feel safe at work. And I think that tone carried through in the campaign. You know, our champion was Alderman Michelle Harris of the 8th Ward, you know, who took up this issue. You know, I think it's common sense, right? When you think about the hotel workers who are working alone in an isolated environment, when with the power dynamic that we mentioned earlier, that it just makes sense that these mostly women should have the ability to call for help when they're in that unique work environment. And so, you know, we're really proud that that we're able to accomplish this together as a city. You know, and it's felt like a long time coming, but, you know, we launched it in October 2016, and it passed October 2017. You know, we're excited now for the implementation of it.
So did the hotels put up much of a fight against this?
Not publicly. We were out there and you know, sharing the stories and the experiences of it, and it's really hard to argue when people share their personal experiences and when you have you know, the widespread numbers that were shown that it was very clearly something needed to be done. You know, we've moved ahead. Mm-hmm. In that way.
And actually, to tell you the truth, I was in a meeting, and I actually had a member of management actually say, like, it was needed. So it's not that it's not being acknowledged, it just was never addressed. You know, this is nothing that has been, this is not behavior that is new behavior. This is something that has been going on for decades.
Right.
This goes way past, you know, my generation, your generation. This has been the culture of the industry towards women. So just the fact that we're turning the arrows around, and we're creating a platform for it to be spoke about and give the people, the women, the power to feel like they're not alone. That's the reason why they didn't speak up in the first place. Mm. You know, a lot of them, they didn't want to feel like, the victims don't want to be victimized, number one. They don't want to feel like they're alone. Some of them don't want to go back home and tell their spouses, their husbands, or, you know, whatever. You know, their kids, it's embarrassment. You know, and plus they have to survive. A lot of them are single mothers. Mm-hmm. I'm a single mom. So if you don't know any better, I got into the industry when I was 23. So if you didn't know any better and they're saying, oh, this is how you're going to go get your money, or this is what you have to endure, this is just a part of the job, then you're going to accept that, right? Who are you to question it? Mm-hmm. You know, who's going to tell you any better if you're, you know, if you're younger, if you're a younger person coming into the industry, or if you're even someone coming from another country that's, you know, that's worse off, that they've endured so much worse, you know, they want to endure that, you know, and nobody should be subject to that.
You know, it makes a huge difference to have a union that's backing this. Here in Kansas City, Unite Here barely exists. They don't represent any hotels, and there's only one hotel in town that has any union at all. So I know hotel workers who live in constant fear. They have sort of a dual fear. They fear ICE and immigration on the one hand, and then they fear the patrons because they don't feel like they have any backup from the hotel management. So,
and really, that's the great thing about this ordinance, because it doesn't only cover the union, hotels. It's for all hotels in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it does really show the strength of our union and how important the unions are, not just our union, the other unions, because they were, you know, we're all brothers and sisters in the movement, and what part they play in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, most definitely.
Yeah. So were there many?
And I think you're so right, Judy. Like when we were looking at, you know, we talked with our members, and we had a moment where we said, like, if can you imagine what's happening in places that don't have a union, right? Where you don't have the protection there. That this is already really hard to talk about. It's hard enough to report harassment by a guest when you have a union. Can you imagine when you don't? And so I think that is, like, to Casey's point, that's why this, you know, that's why this is an ordinance, that it applies to all the hotels, union or non-union. But I also think the point is that we need more, we need to organize, we need to continue to organize. That's the real answer. We were able to pass this law because we're organized and we're the labor movement. You know, we got to continue pushing that way, too. It's bringing awareness. You know, before I did the research, before I did the survey, I wasn't all the way educated on what a room, you know, a room attendant goes through on an everyday basis. Mm-hmm. You know, when we travel, we go into hotels, and we just go into the hotel, la-di-da, right? You're not really thinking about the environment. But these are very intimate spaces. And this is someone's bedroom, temporary bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see it like that, but then you have these predators that look at it that way. You don't really, some of the housekeepers, they even had like a false sense of security as far as they like, oh, well, I got my phone. Or all I have to do, if it's a problem, I could call my phone. You know, these rooms are made for privacy, so they're made for no one to hear on the outside. So what's going to stop somebody from hurting you if you're over there cleaning the tub and your back is turned and he come up behind you while you're down there cleaning up the tub?
Ugh, yes. We're just about out of time, but I have one more question. You all had a party after the ordinance passed, and you had a cake that was decorated with a picture of Harvey Weinstein covered with a circle and a slash through it. And it said on the cake, "No Harveys in Chicago." So going back to the theme I started with, which is that all of the attention has really gone to, you know, high-profile actresses in the entertainment industry or people in government. What else do you think we can do to, you know, bring this whole debate about sexual harassment down to the level of working-class women like your members?
You know, I think we have to continue, I think, organizing. Frankly, like, the union organizing is how we're going to build power. That's why I'm in the labor movement, is that we have to continue to come together. It's so hard to speak out on your own. It's so isolating that to combat it, we're going to have to be together in solidarity. And like the way we do that is through, you know, the way that I've come to it is through the union organizing. I give a lot of credit to reporters like yourself and other journalists who are seeking out the stories of women in industries who aren't often covered. And so I wanted to also thank you for helping lift it up.
Well, you're certainly
like,
welcome.
I'd like to also thank you, but I would also like to thank the housekeepers for telling their stories.
Mm. Absolutely.
It takes a lot of courage for those women to come out here and tell their stories and dig deep and you know, scrape up those scabs that they've been hiding for so long, and to know that their voice wasn't taken in vain. You know, they didn't do that in vain. Somebody actually listened to them, and to know that somebody's actually listened to what you need and how you're feeling on an everyday basis, that you have the right to go to work and be safe, and that somebody should be held accountable for you being safe at working on their property, and most definitely. So that's what that cake was. The cake was victory. That's what that circle was.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Sarah Lyons and Casey Knowles of Unite Here Local 1, for sharing this story. It's truly inspiring.
All right. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, from the January 3rd Wichita Eagle, on January 2nd, two Gavilan Grain Wichita employees were killed after they were buried under 20 to 25 feet of grain in a grain elevator. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration is investigating. OSHA warns that moving grain acts like quicksand and can engulf a person in 22 seconds. OSHA requires workers who enter a grain bin to wear a body harness with a lifeline. In 2016, there were 29 documented grain entrapment cases, 11 which were fatal, according to a study by Purdue University. DeBruce Grain merged with Gavilan Grain in 2010. The Wichita DeBruce Grain elevator exploded in 1998, killing 7 employees and injuring 10. Remembering another past grain explosion from the December 20th Kansas City Star, OSHA slashed fines and dropped the severity of citations in a pending settlement of labor complaints brought after a deadly explosion at an Atchison, Kansas grain elevator 6 years ago. Bartlett Grain Company, based in Kansas City, agreed to $182,000 in fines, safety audits, and improvements at all its 20 grain handling facilities in 6 states. OSHA had proposed $406,000 in fines against Bartlett in relation to the October 29, 2011 explosion that killed 6 workers. The document also said the settlement shall not be construed in any way that respondent, Bartlett Grain, violated the OSHA Act or standards under it. Kevin Bach, whose stepson Chad Roberts was killed, said the settlement was about what he'd expected from OSHA, but not what he wanted. Next, for years, January Safety First has recognized the most important safety news stories from the previous year. This year, Safety First's number one safety news story is summarized by the President's photo op from December 14th. According to the December 15th pumphandle.org, it was a ridiculous photo op. The President standing next to piles of white paper stacked 7 feet high. Next to the tall stacks were a few piles of paper only a foot high. The giant stack had a red label marked today, and the small stack label was 1960. Trump proclaimed, "We're going to cut a ribbon because we're getting back below the 1960 level, and we'll get there fairly quickly." Oh yes, the good old days, 1960, the year when, for example, 325 coal miners were killed on the job, not including disease, compared to 8 deaths in 2016, and the free market allowed industrial facilities to discharge chemical-laden waste into rivers and belch toxics from their smokestacks. Trump's photo op to boast about cutting red tape of regulations coincided with the release of his administration's semi-annual regulatory agenda. He invoked his love of coal and his success at ending the war on coal, but he doesn't show any love for coal miners or their health. The Mine Safety and Health Administration, for example, will be revisiting a regulation put in place in 2014 to better protect coal miners from developing black lung disease. The rule took effect August 2016. Trump's Labor Department says it soon will be asking the coal industry for ideas on ways to make the coal dust reduction rules less burdensome and costly. Safety First considers this an intended rollbacks of regulations, specifically those meant to improve worker health and safety, as major safety news for 2017. Finally, from Slate.com, December 29th, and USA Today, December 28th, the Trump administration is undoing safety and environmental regulations put in place by President Obama after the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon disaster that killed 11 crew members whose bodies were never recovered and for months dumped millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, amounting to the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The catastrophic environmental event led to BP paying $18.7 billion in civil penalties and damages. The Obama-era rules, written in 2016, tightened controls on blowout preventers, devices that are intended to stop explosions in undersea oil and gas wells, and called for rig operators to have third parties certify the safety devices work under extreme conditions. In the Deepwater Horizon spill, a supposedly fail-safe blowout preventer failed after a section of drill pipe buckled. The Department of Interior published the proposed rule on December 29th. The upshot is a weaker regulatory regime over offshore oil and gas drilling. According to the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, housed within the Interior Department, the regulatory changes will save extraction companies some $900 million over 10 years, and argues that the oil industry has learned from its mistakes. Safety and environmental advocates will have until January 29th to comment. Let's work for a better 2018. This is Mary Aria for Safety First.
This is a Heartland Labor Forum calendar for January 2017. What day is it? 18. Oh, my gosh. To find our calendar on the web, go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. First one is Empower Missouri, Missouri Legislative Preview. Friday, January 5th, 8 to 10 a.m., Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral, 415 West 13th Street, Kansas City, Missouri, 64105. Kansas People's Agenda Rally, January 10th, 11:30 a.m., is at the Kansas Capitol in Topeka. Gerrymandering, How It Works and How It Can Affect Elections, Tuesday, January 16th, 2018, at 6 p.m., between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m., at the Community Christian Church, 4601 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri, 64112. It's hosted by the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus. Worker Justice Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft will be Monday, January 22nd, between 5 and 8 p.m. at El Centro, 7th in Minnesota in Kansas City, Kansas. Labor Notes has opened registration for its 2018 Troublemakers Conference, scheduled April 6th through 8th, 2018, in Chicago. For early bird rates, go to labornotes.org/conference. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. Like us on Facebook. Just search for Heartland Labor Forum. Send us your feedback about the show. What do you want to hear? What did you like or hate? Volunteer for the Heartland Labor Forum. Call us at 816-235-1470.
And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Me Too, a roundtable and call-in on sexual harassment. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here
on 90.1 FM, KKFI.